across the North Sea of the lapse of years. But if this young lady was not a good little girl and did not eat her boiled beetroot, then the Tiger Man would put on his big black travelling cloak lined with fur, just like your daddy's, and hire the Earl King's Galloper of Wind and ride through the night straight to the nursery and... Yes, my beauty, gobble you up. How I'd squeal in delighted terror, half believing her, half knowing that she teased me. And there were things I knew that I must not tell her. In our lost farmyard, where the giggling nursemaids initiated me into the mysteries of what the bull did to the cows, I heard about the wagoner's daughter.
Hush, hush! Don't let on to your nursie, we said so. The wagoner's lass, hair-lipped, squint-eyed, ugly as sin, who would have taken her? Yet to her shame, her belly swelled amid the cruel mockery of the ostlers, and her son was born of a bear, they whispered.
Born with a full pelt and teeth. That proved it. But when he grew up, he was a good shepherd, although he never married, lived in a hut outside the village, and could make the wind blow any way he wanted to, besides being able to tell which eggs would become cocks, which hens. The wandering peasants once brought my father a skull with horns 4 inches long on either side of it, and would not go back to the field where their poor plough disturbed it until the priest went with them. For this skull had the jawbone of a man. Had it not? Old wives' tales, nursery fears, I knew well enough the reason for the trepidation I cosily titillated with superstitious marvels of my childhood on the day my childhood ended. For now, my own skin was my sole capital in the world, and today I'd make my first investment. We had left the city far behind us and were now traversing a wide, flat dish of snow where the mutilated stumps of the willows flourished their ciliate heads athwart frozen ditches. Mist diminished the horizon, brought down the sky until it seemed no more than a few inches above us. As far as I could see, not one thing living. How starveling. How bereft the dead season of this spurious Eden in which all the fruit was blighted by cold. And my frail roses, already faded. I opened the carriage door and tossed the defunct bouquet into the rucked, frost-stiff mud of the road. Suddenly a sharp, freezing wind arose and pelted my face with a dry rice of powdered snow. The mist lifted sufficiently to reveal before me an acreage of half-derelict facades of sheer red brick, the vast man-trap, the megalomaniac citadel of his palazzo. It was a world in itself, but a dead one, a burned-out planet. I saw the beast bought solitude, not luxury, with his money. The little black horse trotted smartly through the figured bronze doors that stood open to the weather like those of a barn, and the valet handed me out of the carriage onto the scarred tiles of the great hall itself, into the odorous warmth of a stable, sweet with hay, acrid with horse dung. An equine chorus of neighings and soft drummings of hooves broke out beneath the tall roof, where the beams were scabbed with last summer's swallows' nests. A dozen gracile muzzles lifted from their mangers and turned towards us, ears erect. The beast had given his horses the use of the dining room. The walls were painted, aptly enough, with a fresco of horses, dogs, and men in a wood where fruit and blossom grew on the bough together. The valet tweaked politely at my sleeve. "Milord is waiting." Gaping doors and broken windows let the wind in everywhere. We mounted one staircase after another, our feet clopping on the marble. Through archways and open doors, I glimpsed suites of vaulted chambers opening one out of another like systems of Chinese boxes into the infinite complexity of the innards of the place. He and I and the wind were the only things stirring. And all the furniture was under dust sheets, the chandeliers bundled up in cloth, pictures taken from their hooks and propped with their faces to the walls as if their master could not bear to look at them. The palace was dismantled, as if its owner were about to move house or had never properly moved in. The beast had chosen to live in an uninhabited place. The valet darted me a reassuring glance from his brown, eloquent eyes, yet a glance with so much queer superciliousness in it that it did not comfort me, and went bounding ahead of me on his bandy legs, softly chattering to himself. I held my head high and followed him, but for all my pride, my heart was heavy. Milord has his eyrie high above the house, a small, stifling, darkened room. He keeps his shutters locked at noon. I was out of breath by the time we reached it, and returned to him the silence with which he greeted me. I will not smile. He cannot smile. In his rarely disturbed privacy, the beast wears a garment of Ottoman design. A loose, dull purple gown with gold embroidery round the neck that falls from his shoulders to conceal his feet. The feet of the chair he sits in are handsomely clawed. He hides his hands in his ample sleeves. The artificial masterpiece of his face appalls me. A small fire in a small grate, a rushing wind rattles the shutters. The valet coughed. To him fell the delicate task of transmitting to me his master's wishes. "My master?" A stick fell in the grate. It made a mighty clatter in that dreadful silence. The valet started, lost his place in his speech, began again. "My master has but one desire." The thick, rich, wild scent with which Milord had soaked himself the previous evening hangs all about us, ascends in cursive blue from the smoke of a precious Chinese pot. "He wishes only..." Now, in the face of my impassivity, the valet twittered, his ironic composure gone, for the desire of a master, however trivial, may yet sound unbearably insolent in the mouth of a servant, and his role of go-between clearly caused him a good deal of embarrassment. He gulped. He swallowed. At last contrived to unleash an unpunctuated flood. "My master's sole desire is to see the pretty young lady unclothed, nude, without her dress, and that only for the one time, after which she will be returned to her father undamaged with banker's orders for the sum which he lost to my master at cards, and also a number of fine presents such as furs, jewels, and horses." I remained standing. During this interview, my eyes were level with those inside the mask that now evaded mine as if, to his credit, he was ashamed of his own request, even as his mouthpiece made it for him. "Agitato. Molto agitato," the valet wrung his white-gloved hands.
"Desnuda."
I could scarcely believe my ears. I let out a raucous guffaw. "No young lady laughs like that," my old nurse used to remonstrate. But I did, and do. At the clamour of my heartless mirth, the valet danced backwards with perturbation, palpitating his fingers as if attempting to wrench them off, expostulating, wordlessly pleading. I felt that I owed it to him to make my reply in as exquisite a Tuscan as I could master. "You may put me in a windowless room, sir, and I promise you I will pull my skirt up to my waist ready for you." but there must be a sheet over my face to hide it, though the sheet must be laid over me so lightly that it will not choke me. So I shall be covered completely from the waist upwards, and no lights. There you can visit me once, sir, and only the once. After that, I must be driven directly to the city and deposited in the public square in front of the church. If you wish to give me money, then I should be pleased to receive it. But I must stress that you should give me only the same amount of money that you would give to any other woman in such circumstances. However, if you choose not to give me a present, then that is your right. How pleased I was to see I struck the beast to the heart, for after a baker's dozen heartbeats, one single tear swelled, glittering at the corner of the masked eye. A tear I hoped of shame. The tear trembled for a moment on an edge of painted bone, then tumbled down the painted cheek to fall with an abrupt tinkle on the tiled floor. The valet, ticking and clucking to himself, hastily ushered me out of the room. A mauve cloud of his master's perfume billowed out into the chill corridor with us and dissipated itself on the spinning winds. A cell had been prepared for me. A veritable cell, windowless, airless, lightless, in the viscera of the palace. The valet lit a lamp for me, a narrow bed, a dark cupboard with fruit and flowers carved on it bulked out of the gloom. "I shall twist a noose out of my bed linen and hang myself with it," I said. "Oh, no," said the valet, fixing upon me wide and suddenly melancholy eyes. "Oh, no, you will not. You are a woman of honour." And what was he doing in my bedroom, this jigging caricature of a man? Was he to be my warder until I submitted to the beast's whim, or he to mine? Am I in such reduced circumstances that I may not have a lady's maid? As if in reply to my unspoken demand, the valet clapped his hands. "To assuage your loneliness, madame." A knocking and clattering behind the door of the cupboard. The door swings open, and out glides a soubrette from an operetta, with glossy nut-brown curls, rosy cheeks, blue rolling eyes. It takes me a moment to recognize her, in her little cap, her white stockings, her frilled petticoats. She carries a looking-glass in one hand and a powder-puff in the other. And there is a musical box where her heart should be. She tinkles as she rolls towards me on her tiny wheels. "Nothing human lives here," said the valet. My maid halted, bowed. From a split seam at the side of her bodice protrudes the handle of a key. She is a marvellous machine, the most delicately balanced system of cords and pulleys in the world. "We have dispensed with servants," the valet said. "We surround ourselves instead, for utility and pleasure, with simulacra, and find it no less convenient than do most gentlemen." This clockwork twin of mine halted before me, her bowels churning out a settecento minuet, and offered me the bold carnation of her smile. Click, click. She raises her arm and busily dusts my cheeks with pink powdered chalk that makes me cough, then thrusts towards me her little mirror. I saw within it not my own face, but that of my father, as if I had put on his face when I arrived at the beast's palace as the discharge of his debt. "What, you self-deluding fool, are you crying still?" "And drunk, too." He tossed back his grappa and hurled the tumbler away. Seeing my astonished fright, the valet took the mirror away from me, breathed on it, polished it with the ham of his gloved fist, handed it back to me. Now all I saw was myself, haggard from a sleepless night, pale enough to need my maid's supply of rouge. I heard the key turn in the heavy door and the valet's footsteps patter down the stone passage. Meanwhile, my double continued to powder the air, emitting her jangling tune. But, as it turned out, she was not inexhaustible. Soon she was powdering more and yet more languorously. Her metal heart slowed in imitation of fatigue. Her musical box ran down until the notes separated themselves out of the tune and plopped like single raindrops and, as if sleep had overtaken her, at last she moved no longer. As she succumbed to sleep, I had no option but to do so too. I dropped on that narrow bed as if felled. Time passed, but I do not know how much. Then the valet woke me with rolls and honey. I gestured the tray away, but he set it down firmly beside the lamp and took from it a little shagreen box which he offered me. I turned away my head.
"Oh, my lady!"
Such hurt cracked his high-pitched voice. He dexterously unfastened the gold clasp. On a bed of crimson velvet lay a single diamond earring, perfect as a tear. I snapped the box shut and tossed it into a corner. This sudden sharp movement must have disturbed the mechanism of the doll. She jerked her arm almost as if to reprimand me, letting out a rippling fart of gavotte. Then was still again.
"Very well," said the valet, put out, and indicated it was time for me to visit my host again.
He did not let me wash or comb my hair. There was so little natural light in the interior of the palace that I could not tell whether it was day or night. You would not think the beast had budged an inch since I last saw him. He sat in his huge chair, with his hands in his sleeves, and the heavy air never moved. I might have slept an hour, a night, or a month, but his sculptured calm, the stifling air remained just as it had been. The incense rose from the pot, still traced the same signature on the air. The same fire burned.
"Take off my clothes for you like a ballet girl. Is that all you want of me?"
"The sight of a young lady's skin that no man has seen before," stammered the valet. I wished I'd rolled in the hay with every lad on my father's farm to disqualify myself from this humiliating bargain. That he should want so little was the reason why I could not give it. I did not need to speak for the beast to understand me. A tear came from his other eye. And then he moved. He buried his cardboard carnival head with its ribboned weight of false hair in, I would say, his arms. He withdrew his, I might say, hands from his sleeves, and I saw his furred pads, his excoriating claws. The dropped tear caught upon his fur and shone, and in my room for hours I hear those paws pad back and forth outside my door. When the valet arrived again with his silver salver, I had a pair of diamond earrings of the finest water in the world. I threw the other into the corner where the first one lay. The valet twittered with aggrieved regret, but did not offer to lead me to the beast again. Instead, he smiled ingratiatingly and confided, "My master, he say, invite the young lady to go riding."
"What's this?"
He briskly mimicked the action of a gallop and, to my amazement, tunelessly croaked, "Tantivy, tantivy, a hunting we will go."
"I'll run away. I'll ride to the city."
"Oh, no," he said. "Are you not a woman of honour?" He clapped his hands, and my maidservant clicked and jangled into the imitation of life. She rolled towards the cupboard where she had come from and reached inside it to fetch out, over her synthetic arm, my riding habit. Of all things, my very own riding habit that I'd left behind me in a trunk in a loft in that country house outside Petersburg that we'd lost long ago, before, even, we set out on this wild pilgrimage to the cruel south. Either the very riding habit my old nurse had sewn for me, or else a copy of it, perfect to the lost button on the right sleeve, the ripped hem held up with a pin. I turned the worn cloth about in my hands, looking for a clue. The wind that sprinted through the palace made the door tremble in its frame. Had the north wind blown my garments across Europe to me? At home, the bear's son directed the winds at his pleasure. What democracy of magic held this palace and the fir forest in common? Or should I be prepared to accept it as proof of the axiom my father had drummed into me, that if you have enough money, anything is possible? Tantivy, suggested the now twinkling valet, evidently charmed at the pleasure mixed with my bewilderment. The clockwork maid held my jacket out to me, and I allowed myself to shrug into it, as if reluctantly, although I was half mad to get out into the open air, away from this deathly palace, even in such company. The doors of the hall let the bright day in. I saw that it was morning. Our horses, saddled and bridled, beasts in bondage, were waiting for us, striking sparks from the tiles with their impatient hooves, while their stablemates lolled at ease among the straw, conversing with one another in the mute speech of horses. A pigeon or two, feathers puffed to keep out the gold, strutted about, pecking at ears of corn. The little black gelding who had brought me here greeted me with a ringing neigh that resonated inside the misty roof as in a sounding box, and I knew he was meant for me to ride. I always adored horses, noblest of creatures, such wounded sensitivity in their wise eyes, such rational restraint of energy at their high-strung hindquarters. I lurped and harumphed to my shining black companion, and he acknowledged my greeting with a kiss on the forehead from his soft lips. There was a little shaggy pony nuzzling away at the trompe-l'oeil foliage beneath the hooves of the painted horses on the wall, into whose saddle the valet sprang with a flourish, as of the circus. Then the beast, wrapped in a black fur-lined cloak, came to heave himself aloft a grave grey mare. No natural horseman he. He clung to her mane like a shipwrecked sailor to a spar. Cold that morning, yet dazzling with the sharp winter sunlight that wounds the retina. There was a scurrying wind about that seemed to go with us, as if the masked, immense one who did not speak carried it inside his cloak and let it out at his pleasure. For it stirred the horse's manes, but did not lift the lowland mists. A bereft landscape in the sad browns and sepias of winter lay all about us, the marshland drearily protracting itself towards the wide river. Those decapitated willows. Now and then, the swoop of a bird, its irreconcilable cry. A profound sense of strangeness slowly began to possess me. I knew my two companions were not, in any way, as other men. The simian retainer and the master for whom he spoke, the one with clawed forepaws who was in a plot with the witches who let the winds out of their knotted handkerchiefs up towards the Finnish border. I knew they lived according to a different logic than I had done until my father abandoned me to the wild beasts by his human carelessness. This knowledge gave me a certain fearfulness still. But, I would say, not much. I was a young girl, a virgin, and therefore men denied me rationality, just as they denied it to all those who were not exactly like themselves in all their unreason. If I could see not one single soul in that wilderness of desolation all around me, then the six of us, mounts and riders both, could boast amongst us not one soul either, since all the best religions in the world state categorically that not beasts nor women were equipped with the flimsy, insubstantial things when the good Lord opened the gates of Eden and let Eve and her familiars tumble out. Understand, then, that though I would not say I privately engaged in metaphysical speculation as we rode through the reedy approaches to the river, I certainly meditated on the nature of my own state, how I had been bought and sold, passed from hand to hand. That clockwork girl who powdered my cheeks for me, had I not been allotted only the same kind of imitative life amongst men that the dollmaker had given her? Yet, as to the true nature of the being of this Claude Magus, who rode his pale horse in a style that made me recall how Kublai Khan's leopards went out hunting on horseback, of that I had no notion. We came to the bank of the river that was so wide we could not see across it, so still with winter that it scarcely seemed to flow. The horses lowered their heads to drink. The valet cleared his throat, about to speak. We were in a place of perfect privacy, beyond a break of winter bear rushes, a hedge of reeds. "If you will not let him see you without your clothes," I involuntarily shook my head, "you must then prepare yourself for the sight of my master, naked." The river broke on the pebbles with a diminishing sigh. My composure deserted me. All at once I was on the brink of panic. I did not think that I could bear the sight of him, whatever he was. The mare raised her dripping muzzle and looked at me keenly, as if urging me. This river broke again at my feet. I was far from home. "You," said the valet, "must." When I saw how scared he was I might refuse, I nodded. The reed bowed down in a sudden snarl of wind that brought with it a gust of the heavy odour of his disguise. The valet held out his master's cloak to screen him from me as he removed the mask. The horses stirred. "The tiger will never lie down with the lamb. He acknowledges no pact that is not reciprocal. The lamb must learn to run with the tigers." A great, feline, tawny shape, whose pelt was barred with a savage geometry of bars the colour of burned wood. His domed, heavy head, so terrible he must hide it. How subtle the muscles, how profound the tread. The annihilating vehemence of his eyes, like twin suns. I felt my breast ripped apart as if I suffered a marvellous wound. The valet moved forward, as if to cover up his master now the girl had acknowledged him, but I said, "No." The tiger sat still as a heraldic beast, in the pact he had made with his own ferocity to do me no harm. He was far larger than I could have imagined, from the poor shabby things I'd seen once in the Tsar's menagerie at Petersburg, the golden fruit of their eyes dimming, withering in the far north of captivity. Nothing about him reminded me of humanity. I therefore, shivering, now unfastened my jacket to show him I would do him no harm. Yet I was clumsy and blushed a little. For no man had seen me naked, and I was a proud girl. Pride it was, not shame, that thwarted my fingers so. and a certain trepidation lest this frail little article of human upholstery before him might not be, in itself, grand enough to satisfy his expectations of us, since those, for all I knew, might have grown infinite during the endless time he had been waiting. The wind clattered in the rushes, purled and eddied in the river. I showed his grave silence my white skin, my red nipples, and the horses turned their heads to watch me, also, as if they too were courteously curious as to the fleshly nature of women. Then the beast lowered his massive head. "Enough," said the valet with a gesture. The wind died down. All was still again. Then they went off together, the valet on his pony, the tiger running before him like a hound, and I walked along the river bank for a while. I felt I was at liberty for the first time in my life. Then the winter sun began to tarnish. A few flakes of snow drifted from the darkening sky, and, when I returned to the horses, I found the beast mounted again on his grey mare, cloaked and masked, and once more, to all appearances, a man. While the valet had a fine catch of waterfowl dangling from his hand, and the corpse of a young roebuck slung behind his saddle. I climbed up on the black gelding in silence, and so we returned to the palace, as the snow fell more and more heavily, obscuring the tracks that we had left behind us. The valet did not return me to my cell, but instead to an elegant, if old-fashioned boudoir with sofas of faded pink brocade, a gin's treasury of oriental carpets, tintinnabulation of cut-glass chandeliers. Candles in antlered holders struck rainbows from the prismatic hearts of my diamond earrings that lay on my new dressing table, at which my attentive maid stood ready with her powder puff and mirror. Intending to fix the ornaments in my ears, I took the looking-glass from her hand. But it was in the midst of one of its magic fits again, and I did not see my own face in it, but that of my father. At first I thought he smiled at me. Then I saw he was smiling with pure gratification. He sat, I saw, in the parlour of our lodgings, at the very table where he had lost me. But now he was busily engaged in counting out a tremendous pile of banknotes. My father's circumstances had changed already. Well-shaven, neatly barbered, smart new clothes. A frosted glass of sparkling wine sat convenient to his hand beside an ice bucket. The beast had clearly paid cash on the nail for his glimpse of my bosom, and paid up promptly, as if it had not been a sight I might have died of showing. Then I saw my father's trunks were packed, ready for departure. Could he so easily leave me here? There was a note on the table with the money, in a fine hand. I could read it quite clearly. "The young lady will arrive immediately." Some harlot with whom he'd briskly negotiated a liaison on the strength of his spoils? Not at all. For, at that moment, the valet knocked at my door to announce that I might leave the palace at any time hereafter. And he bore over his arm a handsome sable cloak. My very own little gratuity. The beast's mourning gift, in which he proposed to pack me up and send me off. When I looked at the mirror again, my father had disappeared, and all I saw was a pale, hollow-eyed girl whom I scarcely recognized. The valet asked politely when he should prepare the carriage, as if he did not doubt that I would leave with my booty at the first opportunity, while my maid, whose face was no longer the spit of my own, continued bonnily to beam. "I will dress her in my own clothes, wind her up, send her back to perform the part of my father's daughter." "Leave me alone," I said to the valet. He did not need to lock the door now. I fixed the earrings in my ears. They were very heavy. Then I took off my riding habit, left it where it lay on the floor. But when I got down to my shift, my arms dropped to my sides. I was unaccustomed to nakedness. I was so unused to my own skin that to take off all my clothes involved a kind of flaying. I thought the beast had wanted a little thing compared with what I was prepared to give him, but it is not natural for humankind to go naked, not since first we hid our loins with fig leaves. He had demanded the abominable. I felt as much atrocious pain as if I was stripping off my own underpelt, and the smiling girl stood poised in the oblivion of her balked simulation of life, watching me peel down to the cold, white meat of contract, and, if she did not see me, then so much more like the marketplace where the eyes that watch you take no account of your existence. And it seemed my entire life, since I had left the North, had passed under the indifferent gaze of eyes like hers. Then I was flinching, stark, except for his irreproachable tears. I huddled in the furs I must return to him to keep me from the lacerating winds that raced along the corridors. I knew the way to his den without the valet to guide me. No response to my tentative rap on his door. Then the wind blew the valet whirling along the passage. He must have decided that if one should go naked, then all should go naked. Without his livery, he revealed himself, as I had suspected, a delicate creature covered with silken moth-grey fur. Brown fingers, supple as leather, chocolate muzzle, the gentlest creature in the world. He gibbered a little to see my fine furs and jewels, as if I were dressed up for the opera, and, with a great deal of tender ceremony, removed the sables from my shoulders. The sables thereupon resolved themselves into a pack of black, squeaking rats that rattled immediately down the stairs on their hard little feet and were lost to sight. The valet bowed me inside the beast's room. The purple dressing gown, the mask, the wig, were laid out on his chair. A glove was planted on each arm. The empty house of his appearance was ready for him, but he had abandoned it. There was a reek of fur and piss. The incense pot lay broken in pieces on the floor. Half-burned sticks were scattered from the extinguished fire. A candle stuck by its own grease to the mantelpiece lit two narrow flames in the pupils of the tiger's eyes. He was pacing backwards and forwards, the tip of his heavy tail twitching as he paced out the length and breadth of his imprisonment between the gnawed and bloody bones. "He will gobble you up." Nursery fears made flesh and sinew. Earliest and most archaic of fears, fear of devourment. The beast and his carnivorous bed of bone and eye, white, shaking, raw, approaching him as if offering, in myself, the key to a peaceable kingdom in which his appetite need not be my extinction. He went still as stone. He was far more frightened of me than I was of him. I squatted on the wet straw and stretched out my hand. I was now within the field of force of his golden eyes. He growled at the back of his throat, lowered his head, sank onto his forepaws, snarled, showed me his red gullet, his yellow teeth. I never moved. He snuffed the air, as if to smell my fear. He could not. Slowly, slowly he began to drag his heavy, gleaming weight across the floor towards me. A tremendous throbbing, as of the engine that makes the earth turn, filled the little room, he had begun to purr. The sweet thunder of this purr shook the old walls, made the shutters batter the windows until they burst apart and let in the white light of the snowy moon. Tiles came crashing down from the roof. I heard them fall into the courtyard far below. The reverberations of his purring rocked the foundations of the house. The walls began to dance. I thought, it will all fall. Everything will disintegrate. He dragged himself closer and closer to me until I felt the harsh velvet of his head against my hand. Then a tongue, abrasive as sandpaper. He will lick the skin off me. He dragged himself closer and closer to me until I felt the harsh velvet of his head against my hand. Then a tongue, abrasive as sandpaper. He will lick the skin off me. And each stroke of his tongue ripped off skin after successive skin, all the skins of a life in the world, and left behind a nascent patina of shining hairs. My earrings turned back to water and trickled down my shoulders. I shrugged the drops off my beautiful fur.
Puss in Boots. Figaro here, Figaro there, I tell you. Figaro upstairs, Figaro downstairs, and oh my goodness me, this little Figaro can slip into my lady's chamber, smart as you like, at any time whatsoever he takes the fancy for, don't you know? He's a cat of the world, cosmopolitan, sophisticated. He can tell when a furry friend is the missus' best company. For what lady in all the world could say no to the passionate yet toujours discret advances of a fine marmalade cat? Unless it be her eyes incontinently overflow at the slightest whiff of fur, which happened once, as you shall hear. A Tom, sirs, a ginger Tom, and proud of it. Proud of his fine white shirt front that dazzles harmoniously against his orange and tangerine tessellations. Oh, what a fiery suit of lights have I. Proud of his bird-entrancing eye and more than military whiskers. Proud to a fault, some say, of his fine musical voice. All the windows in the square fly open when I break into impromptu song at the spectacle of the moon above Bergamo. If the poor players in the square, the sullen rout of rugged trash that haunts the provinces, are rewarded with a hail of pennies when they set up their makeshift stage and start their raucous choruses, then how much more liberally do the citizens deluge me with pails of the freshest water, vegetables hardly spoiled, and occasionally slippers, shoes, and boots. Do you see these fine, high, shining leather boots of mine? A young cavalry officer made me the tribute of first one, then, after I celebrate his generosity with a fresh obligato, the moon no fuller than my heart, whoops, I nimbly spring aside, down comes the other. Their high heels will click like castanets when Puss takes his promenade upon the tiles, for my song recalls flamenco. All cats have a Spanish tinge, although Puss himself elegantly lubricates his virile, muscular, native Bergamasque with French, since that's the only language in which you can purr. Merci. Instantaire, I draw my new boots on over the natty white stockings that terminate my hinder legs. That young man, observing with curiosity by moonlight the use to which I put his footwear, calls out, "Hey, Puss! Puss there!" "At your service, sir."
"Up to my balcony, young Puss."
He leans out in his nightshirt, offering encouragement as I swing succinctly up the facade, forepaws on a curly cherub's pate, hindpaws on a stucco wreath. Bring them up to meet your forepaws while first paw forward, hop, onto the stone nymph's tit, left paw down a bit. The satyr's bum should do the trick. Nothing to it, once you know how. Rococo's no problem. Acrobatics? Born to them. Puss can perform a back somersault while holding aloft a glass of vino in his right paw and never spill a drop. But, to my shame, the famous death-defying triple somersault, on plein air, that is, in middle air, that is, unsupported and without a safety net, I, Puss, have never yet attempted, though often I have dashingly brought off the double tour to the applause of all. "You strike me as a cat of parts," says this young man when I'm arrived at his windowsill. I made him a handsome genuflection, rump out, tail up, head down, to facilitate his friendly chuck under my chin, and, as involuntary free gift, my natural, my habitual smile. For all cats have this particularity, each and every one, from the meanest alley sneaker to the proudest, whitest she that ever graced a pontiff's pillow. We have our smiles, as it were, painted on. Those small, cool, quiet Mona Lisa smiles, that smile we must, no matter whether it's been fun or it's been not. So all cats have a politician's air. We smile and smile, and so they think we're villains. But I note, this young man is something of a smiler himself. "A sandwich," he offers, "and perhaps a snifter of brandy." His lodgings are poor, though he's handsome enough, and even en déshabillé, a nightcap and all, there's a neat, smart, dandified air about him. Here is one who knows what's what, thinks I. A man who keeps up appearances in the bedchamber can never embarrass you out of it. And excellent beef sandwiches. I relish a lean slice of roast beef and early learned a taste for spirits, since I started life as a wine shop cat, hunting cellar rats for my keep, before the world sharpened my wits enough to let me live by them. And the upshot of this midnight interview? I'm engaged on the spot. A sir's valet. Valet de chambre. And from time to time his body servant, for when funds are running low, as they must do for every gallant officer when the pickings fall off, he pawns the quilt, doesn't he? Then faithful Puss curls up on his chest to keep him warm at nights. And if he don't like me to knead his nipples, which, out of the purest affection and the desire, "Ouch," he says, to test the retractability of my claws, I do, in moments of absence of mind, then what other valet could slip into a young girl's sacred privacy and deliver her a billet doux at the very moment when she's reading her prayer book with her sainted mother? A task I once or twice perform for him, to his infinite gratitude. And, as you will hear, brought him at last to the best of fortunes for us all. So Puss got his post at the same time as his boots, and I dare say the master and I have much in common, for he's proud as the devil, touchy as tin tacks, lecherous as licorice, and though I say it as loves him, as quick-witted a rascal as ever put on clean linen. When times were hard, I pilfered the market for breakfast, a herring, an orange, a loaf. We never went hungry. Puss served him well in the gaming salons, too, for a cat may move from lap to lap with impunity and cast his eye over any hand of cards. A cat can jump on the dice. He can't resist to see it roll. Poor thing, mistook it for a bird. And after I've been limp-spined, stiff-legged, playing the silly buggers, scooped up to be chastised, who can remember how the dice fell in the first place? And we had, besides, less gentlemanly means of maintenance when they closed the tables to us as churlishly as they sometimes did. I'd perform my little Spanish dance while he went round with his hat. Olé! But he only put my loyalty and affection to the test of this humiliation when the cupboard was as bare as his backside. After, in fact, he'd sunk so low as to pawn his drawers. So all went right as ninepence, and you never saw such boon companions as Puss and his master, until the man must needs go fall in love.
head over heels, puss.
I went about my ablutions, tonguing my arsehole with the impeccable hygienic integrity of cats, one leg stuck in the air like a ham bone. I choose to remain silent. Love, what has my rakish master, for whom I've jumped through the window of every brothel in the city, besides haunting the virginal back garden of the convent and God knows what other goatish errands, to do with the tender passion? And she, a princess in a tower, remote and shining as Aldebaran, chained to a dolt and dragon-guarded. I withdrew my head from my privates, and fixed him with my most satiric smile. I dare him warble on in that strain. All cats are cynics, he opines, quailing beneath my yellow glare. It is the hazard of it draws him, see? There is a lady, sits in a window for 1 hour and 1 hour only at the tenderest time of dusk. You can scarcely see her features, the curtains almost hide her. Shrouded like a holy image, she looks out at the piazza as the shops shut up, the stores go down, the night comes on. And that is all the world she ever sees. Never a girl in all Bergamo so secluded, except on Sundays they let her go to mass, bundled up in black, with a veil on. And then she is in the company of an aged hag, her keeper, who grumps along grim as a prison dinner. How did he see that secret face? Who else but Puss revealed it? Back we come from the table so late, so very late at night. We found, to our emergent surprise, that all at once it was early in the morning. His pockets were heavy with silver, and both our guts sweetly agurgle with champagne. Lady Luck had sat with us. What fine spirits were we in! Winter and cold weather. The pious trot to church already with little lanterns through the chill fog as we go ungodly rolling home. See a black bark, like a state funeral, and Puss takes it into his bubbly addled brain to board her. Tacking obliquely to her side, I rub my marmalade pate against her shin. How could any duenna, be she never so stern, take offence at such attentions to her chargeling from a little cat? As it turns out, this one, tissue, does. A white hand, fragrant as Arabia, descends from the black cloak and reciprocally rubs behind his ears at just the ecstatic spot. Puss lets rip a roaring purr, rears briefly on his high-heeled boots, jig with joy and pirouette with glee. She laughs to see and draws her veil aside. Puss glimpses high above, as it were, an alabaster lamp lit behind by dawn's first flush, her face. And she's smiling. For a moment, just that moment, you would have thought it was May morning.
"Come along. Come. Don't dawdle over the nasty beast,"
snaps the old hag. With the one tooth in her mouth and warts, she sneezes. The veil comes down, so cold it is and dark again. It was not I alone who saw her. With that smile, he swears she stole his heart. Love. I've sat inscrutably by and washed my face and sparkling dicky with my clever paw, while he made the beast with two backs with every harlot in the city, besides a number of good wives, dutiful daughters, rosy country girls come to sell celery and endive on the corner, and the chambermaid who strips the bed, what's more. The mayor's wife even shed her diamond earrings for him, and the wife of the notary unshuffled her petticoats, and, if I could, I would blush to remember how her daughter shook out her flax and plaits and jumped in bed between them, and she not 16 years old. But never the word love has fallen from his lips, nor in nor out of any of these transports, until my master saw the wife of Signor Pantaleoni as she went walking out to mass. And she lifted up her veil, though not for him. And now he is half sick with it, and will go to the tables no more for lack of heart, and never even pats the bustling rump of the chambermaid in his new-found maudlin celibacy. So we get our slops left festering for days, and the sheets filthy, and the wench goes banging about bad-temperedly with her broom enough to fetch the plaster off the walls. I'll swear he lives for Sunday morning, though never before was he a religious man. Saturday nights he bathes himself punctiliously, even, I'm glad to see, washes behind his ears, perfumes himself, presses his uniform so you'd think he had a right to wear it. So much in love, he very rarely panders to the pleasures even of Onan, as he lies tossing on his couch, for he cannot sleep for fear he miss the summoning bell. Then out into the cold morning, harking after that black vague shape, hapless fisherman for this sealed oyster with such a pearl in it. He creeps behind her across the square. How can so amorous bear to be so inconspicuous? And yet he must, though sometimes the old hag sneezes and says she swears there's a cat about. He will insinuate himself into the pew behind milady, and sometimes contrive to touch the hem of her garment. When they all kneel, and never a thought to his orisons, she is the divinity he's come to worship. Then sits silent in a dream till bedtime. What pleasure is his company for me? He won't eat, either. I brought him a fine pigeon from the inn kitchen, fresh off the spit, parfumé avec tarragon, but he wouldn't touch it, so I crunched it up, bones and all. Performing, as ever after meals, my meditative toilette, I pondered thus. One, he is in a fair way to ruining us both by neglecting his business. Two, love is desire sustained by unfulfillment. If I lead him to her bedchamber, and there he takes his fill of her lily-white, he'll be right as rain in two shakes, and next day tricks as usual. Then master and his puss will soon be solvent once again. Which, at the moment, very much not, sir. This Signor Pantaleone employs, his only servant but the hag, a kitchen cat, a sleek, spry tabby, whom I accost. Grasping the slack of her neck firmly between my teeth, I gave her the customary tribute of a few firm thrusts of my striped loins, and, when she got her breath back, she assured me in the friendliest fashion the old man was a fool and a miser who kept herself on short commons for the sake of the mousing, and the young lady, a soft-hearted creature who smuggled breast of chicken and sometimes, when the hag dragon governess napped at midday, snatched this pretty kitty out of the hearth and into her bedroom to play with reels of silk and run after trailed handkerchiefs, when she and she had as much fun together as two Cinderellas at an all-girls ball. Poor lonely lady, married so young to an old dodderer, with his bald pate and his goggle eyes and his limp, his avarice, his gore belly, his rheumatics, and his flag hangs all the time at half-mast indeed, and jealous as he is impotent. Tabby declares he'd put a stop to all the rutting in the world if he had his way, just to certify his young wife don't get from another what she can't get from him. Then shall we hatch a plot to antler him, my precious? Nothing loath, she tells me the best time for this accomplishment should be the one day in all the week he forsakes his wife and his counting-house, to ride off into the country to extort most grasping rents from starveling tenant farmers. And she's left all alone then, behind so many bolts and bars you wouldn't believe, all alone, but for the hag. Aha! This hag turns out to be the biggest snag. An iron-plated, copper-bottomed, sworn man-hater of some 60 bitter winters who, as ill luck would have it, shatters, clatters, erupts into paroxysms of the sneeze at the very glimpse of a cat's whisker. No chance of puss worming his winsome way into that one's affections, nor for my tabby neither. But, oh, my dear, I say, see how my ingenuity rises to this challenge. So we resume the sweetest part of our conversation in the dusty convenience of the coal hole, and she promises me, least she can do, to see the fair, hitherto inaccessible one, gets a letter safe if I slip it to her. And slip it to her, forthwith I do, though somewhat discommoded by my boots.